It's April 27th, 2018, and we're here in Grinnell, Iowa.
I'm Catherine Yetter.
I'm Sarah McCarthy.
I'm Julian Ricks.
And I'm Chris Brunet.
We're talking today about genital surgery and aesthetics.
We started by just talking to some people about what they thought of their own and other people's perceptions of genitals.
What do you see in these pictures?
I mean, they're both pretty much just dicks.
One is circumcised and one isn't. Maybe the circumcised penis looks better. I think people think like circumcised is more normal.
It's probably more present in like porn.
I think because people are generally more concerned about like there are like health concerns sort of with being uncircumcised sometimes, but also there's like religious reasons why people are circumcised.
These are drawings of a woman's pelvic area.
And do you notice a difference between the two photos at all?
Oh, interesting. Okay, I see. But I think the other one is either a circumcised vagina or like surgically constructed one.
What, so it's like the labia minora lips are a little bit bigger in this one?
I think the labias are a bit different. Like, on the left, the lips are larger, but I mean, they just come in different shapes.
No, I feel like I've heard somewhere that like most people have like really like protruding labia.
I think that it's just more normal to have like a larger labia.
I think typically people tend to like a smaller labia. It seems like an odd thing to have a preference for, although it seems less odd to me to have a preference for circumcised or uncircumcised, but they really are pretty similar.
I think we did see a lot of this confusion when we were talking to people in our initial interviews about what is the proper name. I think we heard everything from anatomical naming to, I think someone said pelvic area as their description. And also sort of comparing people's reactions to the circumcised penis and labiaplasty, that people sort of immediately recognized a circumcised versus uncircumcised penis, whereas people tended to be more confused about what the difference between the pre and post labiaplasty were.
Well, I think part of that comes from the fact that we intentionally didn't tell them this is a pre and post diagram of what happens to your body. And instead, people were really quick to think, oh, well, this other picture looks like someone naturally just has really small labias. No, they're absent from the photo.
Mm-hmm. No, I thought that was really true because I think it is cool. Like, it's good that they're like, maybe some, this is just a smaller set. But if we showed them a picture of somebody that was missing like a different appendage, they'd be like, oh, it's a person without an arm. It wasn't looking at the picture and saying, this is a part of my body that's missing and completely absent from the photo. It was just I'm not familiar enough to say that it couldn't be there. Or, like, I want to acknowledge that it could be, but I'm just not seeing it. But instead of, like, I don't think we would have gotten the same reaction for a different body part.
But also there's this assumption that, well, maybe someone out there has that perfect pelvic area. And, you know, maybe that's the norm. You wouldn't look at a photo of a circumcised penis and say, oh, maybe that person just has a really, 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 really small foreskin.
We'll start by talking today about circumcision. If you're not previously familiar, circumcision in males is the medical removal of the foreskin. We'll be discussing some theory, facts, and also talking to someone who had a medical circumcision later in life and their perceptions of it.
One thing I thought was really interesting was that while a lot of people, especially in the beginning of our podcast, talked about circumcision as the norm, and it's true that most people in the U.S. are circumcised, the CDC reports that the rate of circumcision has dropped precipitously from 56% in 2006 to 32.5% in 2009.
Yeah, and what's also really interesting is this is not a global phenomenon. The NIH had a study where they found that globally only 38.7% of males were circumcised. In the U.S., however, that number is well above 70. So there's kind of this assumption that in the U.S., to be, quote, normal, you know, you have to be circumcised, but then you look at the data and that's not true all overall, you know, in the rest of the world.
So in a study done by Moore and Kent, they looked at between the years of 1996 and 2005 in San Francisco, the rates of circumcision at an STD clinic. They say that male circumcision may have been modestly protective against syphilis in HIV-uninfected heterosexual men. So there is some evidence that cutting off the foreskin helps protect the penis and like keep it clean, and like the idea that it's helping to spread disease.
There's a number of other reasons that people cite for the medical necessity of circumcision. Some people feel that their foreskin is too tight. We talked to one person who had an emergency medical circumcision at age 10 due to an infection. This interview was originally conducted between myself and someone who wishes to remain anonymous, so it's been generously re-recorded by Catherine and a voice actor, Joseph Notke.
Can you just explain why you had a circumcision or the reasoning medical staff gave for it?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly, but there was an infection, and I just remember being told at the time that circumcision was the solution to it. I was at my grandpa's house in Oregon in the summer, and it was bad. Like, I couldn't pee without being in excruciating pain, and it was funny colors. I think they put me on antibiotics for a little bit, and then when I got back, I mean, I don't remember the exact time frame, but it wasn't an overnight thing.
And it cleared it up right away? Like, a sound medical fix?
Yeah.
Do you think your life, or even your sex life, would be different had that not happened, or if you were uncircumcised?
Hard to say, right? Probably not in any major way.
Do you think if you hadn't had a procedure, or other people who were uncircumcised would consider voluntarily having a circumcision later in life if they thought it had medical benefits or was cleaner?
Not me, but probably some people. I don't think unless I was told that I was like missing out on something really great, I wouldn't, but I'm sure that some people would or have.
There's also now currently an increase in literature amongst academics where there's starting to be a prevailing norm acknowledging that there is no medical necessity for circumcision. And a lot of times it can be typical to equate this to like the unnecessary removal of other body parts. Like if a doctor were to say, oh, that's like a pinky on your hand, you don't really need it, we can just cut it off because you'll look nicer. You know, that would be malpractice. Like, you're not allowed to just remove other body parts unnecessarily as a medical professional. But then why is there this norm that that's okay when it's done for a moral reason?
Yeah, I think that's one of the interesting things that makes this a complicated topic, is that it's so culturally tied, but it's also become so heavily medicalized that the two are strangely hard to separate, and it's hard to make an argument about one without dealing with the other. We're now going to move from talking about the practice of circumcision into talking about labiaplasty and comparing the differences and similarities between the two. In general, labiaplasty refers to a cosmetic procedure, which is a surgical cutting away of the labia minora.
So in researching this, we started to wonder when this kind of started, and there are reports of cutting off parts of women's genitals stemming way back as a treatment for kleptomania.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many factors going into why people even choose to get the procedure, like you were mentioning, and there actually are some really interesting interviews with doctors that have been published in places like Off Our Backs that really talk about how across the board, there's a general norm of men coercing women into getting all sorts of vaginal cosmetic surgeries, whether that's a procedure like vaginal rejuvenation or a labiaplasty. And actually, Dr. Young, a doctor from Florida, said that the most common reason why women say that they're getting a labiaplasty is a negative comment made by a male sexual partner.
One article that we were reading on activism on the medicalization of sex points to the release of Viagra as really kind of the beginning of medicalization of sex. And the author, Lenore Tyfer, talks about how she thinks sex has now moved from this realm of like your personal experience with sex to the realm of medicalization. Her big point is that medicalization of sex compounds on women's own oppression. And so if sex isn't going well, then they have to ask themselves, what did I do wrong? And the medical profession is here to say, like, we have a cure for you at, you know, whatever the cost of a labiaplasty is.
Our sound editor, Jill Ricks, went to a cosmetic surgeon to have a consultation about a labiaplasty, so we could hear some thoughts from someone who performs the procedure about what they thought its purpose was.
So I have you hold this mirror.
Okay.
And, because I just want to make sure that we're understanding anatomy. So labia majora,
mm-hmm.
right there, and this is the menorah.
Okay. Here. Yeah.
Right there, and that's what bothers you?
Yes, yes.
So it's a little bit. It's about the same on both sides, so pretty good symmetry. So let's really make an incision from here.
Okay.
So that is gone.
Gotcha.
So basically we like show up at this Des Moines plastic surgery place and it was really surreal. My body was very much quickly reduced to like something that needed to be fixed, and having this nurse like kind of validate all my concerns about myself and be like, yeah, this is like a really common thing that happens to people, and like it was an entirely different atmosphere even like around the doctor, who in the recording said that he's not like a vagina expert, but he was like making comments about like which types of procedures he thought looked best and which types of procedures he didn't like.
The labia really serve no purpose other than appearance, and so when it's enlarged like that, it can be troubling for people. Now we don't want to, I was trained by a gynecologist in California, and out there they remove, with some people who want it, they'll remove all of the labia, mm-hmm. which in my opinion, when I was out there, I thought that that's not that I'm like this vaginal appearance expert, but I just did look at it and like, there's something missing there.
Okay, yeah.
And so I don't do that. People in Iowa don't really want it. They just don't want to be that extra.
He also talked about how like, some women decide to get it because they don't like the way their labia looks like in tight pants, or that like the camel toe kind of thing, and that like women might get it to avoid that happening so they can wear tighter yoga pants or so they can bike. All these other reasons that I might want to get it kind of just came out of the air from this nurse and this doctor.
Well, there's two types of patients that we do labiaplasties on. That's the most common vaginal surgery that I do. There's others, but labiaplasty is number one.
Okay.
And I would say probably 50-60% are pre-kid. The other, you would think that they would all be post-kid, so things get stretched out for whatnot. But I would say the majority, at least that I see, are they're just born that way.
And he looked at me for probably 15 seconds and told me that I would be a good candidate for the surgery.
One thing I think is really tricky to consider with this procedure, especially since it's not covered by insurance, is consent. And can you trust the advice of a doctor who's going to make an awful lot of money off of this procedure when there is a power structure? That makes consent very, very difficult because you can also be coerced into things. We talked about two procedures in which what could be considered excess skin is removed from genital areas, but the perceptions of male circumcision and a labiaplasty are so different.
Well, I think part of it, from my perspective, is that labiaplasty, as known as labiaplasty instead of genital cutting, is a newer phenomenon in a lot of ways. And I think because circumcision has these like historic religious roots, the majority of people in the United States who have penises also are circumcised. And I think that really adds to them being treated as differently. It's normal to talk about like, oh, a circumcised or uncircumcised penis, but because fewer people have labiaplasties, like we don't talk about it as like, oh, do you still have your labia minora, or do you not have your labia minora? Also, in this podcast, we've been talking a lot about these two procedures and issues of consent around these procedures, but I think we all feel like we would be amiss if we didn't also talk about intersex procedures that happen at birth or, you know, within the first 5 years oftentimes of a child's life, where a child is born with genitalia that is seemingly ambiguous, and the doctors at the time decide to undergo some sort of medical procedure with this child to make their genitalia look more like a vagina or more like a penis. And so how the medicalization of gender and of sex goes into what genitalia is constructed for this child. And they, in the Medical Construction of Gender article by Kessler, she talks about how a lot of surgeons talk about this need for their parents to be sent home with a boy or a girl.
The way that doctors oftentimes handle the cases of these intersex infants also relies on them differently valuing the sexual pleasure that a penis or a clitoris would have. And in that, it's more acceptable for there to be the notion that there would be female genitalia that would not be able to have an orgasm than male genitalia that would not be able to orgasm.
I think that these are all sort of complicated and difficult topics to talk about, but that we've really sort of come far in the theory and in the details of talking about the cultural meaning and the necessity of some of these procedures and their similarities and their differences. I think that looking at all of these things helps us come to some conclusions about why people have these procedures, who has power in these procedures, the cultural meaning behind these procedures, and how we build identity or communities around these procedures. I think we've seen that across the board, people feel that even though our constructions of what normal is, particularly in terms of general aesthetics, that people feel strong cultural ties or cultural pressures to sort of fit into that norm, despite what alteration or surgery it might take.